Our next presenter is Dr. Ciodio Frank Nina. I'll give you officially, he's the professor of multicultural and postcolonial transnational culture, literature, and criticism here at East Carolina. He was coordinated the graduate multicultural and transnational literature program for 15 years. He's really the driving force behind why we're here. Even when I was a student, I turned to Dr. Dina for many things, and now that I'm on faculty, I still come back to him, and I probably bother him too much with all, but he just seems to have an answer for everything, which is wonderful. So think of really tough questions for the Q&A after that. But again, he's a wonderful scholar. The greatest story I ever heard was one of my students needed either a humanities or a literature elective, and I said, well, look at either African-American lit or Caribbean lit or world lit, and they wanted to take it on the graduate level. And they said, oh, I said, well, you've got to take Dr. Dina's class. And they came back and I said, are you enjoying it? And they said, yes, we are, but you didn't tell us he wrote the book. So they were a little intimidated to ask a question when he actually wrote the textbook that many of the classes use. But it is a privilege to welcome him and to speak to us this morning.
If I was not suffering from a stiff neck, I would have just put him, you know. But I know we're kind of running behind time, and I'm going to try to race through. But we do have gaps that we will actually catch up. So let not your hearts be troubled. I want to say that I know Angie is doing something on Another Life by Derek Walcott. As Jeff was presenting here, I was thinking, that was really my other life. I was a math history major, and I was actually, after graduating under the French system, I was teaching in a high school, and I was teaching agricultural science. And that was my dream job, that I was actually accepted to the agricultural science school at the same time as accepted at the teacher's college. So it was, you know, but anyhow. And my as a young man, teenager coming out of high school, under the British system, if you have A-levels, you can teach in high school. My goal was to become this agricultural scientist in the rural area, because I was promised a motorcycle. And, I still ride a motorcycle, but it didn't work out, you know. So here I am. I am talking about the title of this paper, The Marriage of Caribbean Studies with Postcolonial and Multicultural Criticism. And I have a list of some of the critics, authors that I mentioned, but for the sake of time, I may just leave that out. So now it's 5 past, and I guess I will shorten my 30 minutes maybe to 20, 25, wherever it takes me. All right, so through its marriage with postcolonial and multicultural criticism, Caribbean studies has become an emergent and a popular culture, producing 21st century cutting-edge literature and two Nobel literature laureates, Derek Walcott in 1992 and V.S. Naipaul in 2001. The Caribbean, however, more than any other region, has suffered most uniquely from colonial exploitation, oppression, and marginalization. But it is only now receiving some critical attention and international recognition. Proportionately in geography and population to other regions like India, Africa, and Central and South America, the Caribbean or West Indies has been the recipient of a longer and more intense period of colonial domination and fragmentation. The eye of the hurricane, and this is my coining, Hurricane European Colonization, HEC, and I actually have a little thing there that's HEC there, there in India, and now Central America and the Caribbean. So HEC has hit the innocent and unprepared Caribbean in a ferocious and devastating manner. Bill Ashcroft, Garrett Griffith, and Helen Tiffin concur in The Empire Writes Back that, quote, in the Caribbean, the European imperial enterprise ensured that the worst features of colonialism throughout the globe would all be combined in one region, end quote. In reality, slavery in the Caribbean commenced from the time of Christopher Columbus's discovery or rediscovery of Hispaniola in 1492 and ceased in the 1960s, which means over 550 years of displacement and dislocation. Prior to Columbus's entrance in the Caribbean, Amerindians, what we call here Native Americans, occupied all the Caribbean islands, and those inhabitants were the center of Caribbean life, culture, and history. But Europeans' entrance and presence in the Caribbean forced a massive and most cruel genocide of the natives, quote, virtually eliminated, except for a small percentage in Dominica and Guyana. The inhabitants of the Caribbean found themselves pushed from the center of life, culture, and history through oppression and exploitation from the colonizers, namely the Dutch, the French, the Portuguese, the Spanish, and English. And in fact, that's one of the beautiful emergence of the Caribbean that Eric Walcott called a very mosaic vase that is in the Caribbean, giving out a sweet-smelling savor to the people from overseas. I am originally from Guyana, which was British Guyana, and right in that one area there, there were five Guyanas, and it was spelled G-U-I-A-N-A, which is an indigenous word meaning land of many waters. There was Portuguese Guyana, there was Dutch Guyana, there was French Guyana, there was Spanish Guyana, and there was British Guyana. So British Guyana is which country now? That's a simple test. Guyana, I just said it. But it's spelled G-U-Y-A-N-A now. And Portuguese Guyana is?
Guyana.
No. Portuguese Guyana is Brazil. So that gives you a clue now. Spanish Guyana is? Venezuela. French Guyana remains French Guyana. And Dutch Guyana is? Yeah. No. No wonder we're students. No, Suriname. And all those countries are right along within the same place there. If you look at South America, Guyana, Brazil, Venezuela, Suriname, the side there, and French Guyana also, you can actually travel the five Guyanas. I learned that late in life. I didn't know that growing up. I never taught me that in school. So, the sociological picture of marginalization parallels the natives' marginalization in Caribbean studies and Caribbean literature. And here is a little quote by one of the leading critic and writer, Kenneth Ramchand. He says, the Aboriginal, that's another name we call him, the Aboriginal Indian seldom appears and is not at the center of social and political interest, either in verse, in drama, or in fiction by writers from the West Indies or the Caribbean. Indeed, the fiction is which the contemporary Indians do appear either registers them as detribalized individuals in the tongues, Bucks, B-U-C-K-S, or portrays them as exotic groups in the interior, end quote. And that has become, that was the name that they were called, B-U-C-K-S, but that has become just like the N-word that we have in the United States of America. few writers, H.G. DeLister, Edgar Mittelhauser, Wilson Harris, Jan Carew, and Derek Walcott, include the Amerindian presence in their works. But apart from Wilson Harris, the other writers place the natives outside of the center of action as background, foil characters, or props. Wilson Harris, however, discovered relevance in the Indians, involving them in three of the basic themes of his fiction. One, the unity of all men. Two, the theme of rebirth. And three, the search for ancestral roots. Slavery. According to Colin A. Palmer, the Amerindians were, and Colin Palmer was at UNC up until recently, I don't know where he is now, a historian, enslaved and required to work in the fields, households, and mines. But many Indians soon died from mistreatment and disease, which created a shortage of labor. After several years of death, disease, and genocide, the dramatic demise of the Indian population provided the opportunity for the Spanish to request African slaves in 1501, capitalizing on the 1479 treaty that Portugal had agreed to supply the Spanish with African slaves. And by 1502, the machinery of the slave trade to the Caribbean began. By 1650, the Dutch, French, and English joined the Portuguese and Spanish in their, quote, human commerce, end quote. Through the Atlantic slave trade between 1502 and 1870, 10 to 12 million slaves were imported to the Americas and Caribbean. From this conservative figure, 0.2 million went to Central America, 0.5 million to South America, 0.5 million to the United States of America, 5 million to Brazil, 5 million to the Caribbean. So the Caribbean alone had 42% of the African slaves, and with neighboring Brazil, they had 84% of the African slaves that came. And I did something there that actually indicated that. Indentured servantship. Slavery in the Caribbean was succeeded by Indian indentureship during the period of 1838-1917. According to Moses C. Sinorine, from the 1500s onward, European settlers colonized the Caribbean and Americas with enslaved Africans and indentured Indians and other ethnic groups who worked on their plantation. These capitalists needed labor to generate profits, and so indentured, like slavery, became from the start a violent, involuntary process in which hundreds of thousands of people were kidnapped and tricked into migrating from South Asia. I've been traveling to different countries in Africa and different places in India. And my first time in West Africa, I thought, oh my God, if I close my eyes and then open my eyes and look at the landscape, I would think, wow, this is just like Guyana or the rest of the Caribbean in terms of some of the pictures I was looking up there, you know, the tropical kind of farming that was going on. And then my first time into India, they actually took me into some of the rice fields, and I thought, wow, this is like the world that I came from the Caribbean. The rice plantations and the fields, and it's amazing how these three worlds emerge in a kind of a European construction of the Caribbean there. Fascinating ways of looking at the world. But this was part of a larger indentureship, the third wave of Indian migration, according to Mahin Hussein, during which time East Indian movement out of India during the indentureship period was rather profound as millions began settling in the numerous countries around the world. Skipping through. This actually has also, I have a thing that shows, let's see if we could find it, I don't know. these are some of the writers that I made reference to. I have a graph that shows different countries that where Indians were brought. Like we would never know that indentured servants were brought to places like Uganda, Mauritius, of course Guyana, New Zealand, Trinidad, Suriname, Fiji, and so forth. In fact, recently I was in Malaysia, and I was surprised to find that a large percentage of Chinese and Indians from South India were brought there as indentured servants, working on the palm oil plantation to this day. You know, and the living conditions are similar to what I've heard stories or read in history books about the Caribbean. In totality, European imperialism in the Caribbean resulted in, quote, the virtual annihilation of the native population of Caribs and Arawaks. I mean, it's a few pictures of them. The plundering and the piracy among the European powers, and the slave trade and plantation slavery, the subsequent systems of indenture which stranded Chinese and Indians in the Caribbean when the return clause of indentured contracts were dishonored, end quote by Ashcroft. In an era of globalization, the Caribbean continues to experience neo-colonial silencing and domination. It is too small, too poor, and too fragmented, some would claim, to be a major player in the world of international politics, economics, and culture, thus leaving West Indians in the alternatives of mimicry, according to B.S. Naipaul, the Mimic Man, madness, according to Jean Rhys, White Sagacity, and migration, according to George Lamming, in the Castle of My Skin, Naipaul's Miguel Street, Samuel Selvan, as we were referred to last night, the Lonely Londoners. This region, rich in natural tourists and manufacturing resources, has supplied several European nations with wealth and intellect to expand their empires. It has also supplied luxury and culture to refresh and refurbish millions of diseased and decaying tourist and business enterprises. Yet, the Caribbean has never been the host of the World Cup, soccer, Olympics, international conferences, and so on. Even though, as Tim would remind us, the Caribbean, or under the name of West Indies, won the world's first World Cup cricket in 1975, Tim?
Yes.
And then they just won this year's World Cup cricket. You know, he's the cricket historian there. For the first time, I'm skipping through some here. In the recent documentary series End of Empire, produced by Brian Lapping, the only region that was not produced was the Caribbean. I remember I was doing NEH summer at University of Austin, Texas. And I was the only non-historian there. But because of my interest in history and post-colonial studies, I was invited to go. And Roger, whatever his name, I can't remember the name. He was the only American commissioned to be the commanding general editor of the Oxford Five volume History of the British colonies. But there was no volume, there was no section on the Caribbean. And I asked this question, and of course the answer was that we ran out of funding. I thought, you know, because I was the only person probably with Caribbean heritage there, and said, this is not right. This is colonialism all over again. They're writing the history. At least they could have had some historians from the Caribbean write a chapter. I mean, it wouldn't take long to just add. So
In Brian Lapping's documentary also, that's the same thing that happened. They just ignored the Caribbean. And they're dealing with the end of the British Empire. How can you talk about the British Empire without all those English-speaking countries within the Caribbean?
Yeah. So that's something that I've raised in this paper. I will skip through here.
What I basically try to do here, I focus on works of and by Franz Fanon, C.L.R. James, O.R. Dayton, who his last state was University of Kentucky, James Azair, Derek Walcott, Edward Gissant, Jean Rhys, V.S. Naipaul, George Lamming, E.R. Braithwaite, Z. Edgell, Christina Garcia, Earl Lovis, Trevor Roan, Moore Collins, Samuel Selvon, Michelle Cliff, Jamaica Kincaid, Brenda Doe Harris, Wilson Harris, and Carl Phillips and a few others, to explore this whole concept that long before theories and criticism like post-colonialism and multiculturalism and transculturalism and transnationalism came into being, they were already in practical form within the Caribbean, because the Caribbean is so multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilingual, multiracial, and the people come together. In fact, Guyana is known as the land of many waters, but Guyana is also known as the land of many races. If you go to Belize, our friend will tell you that almost every person has at least two ethnicity or more, speak two languages or more. And I've done that kind of survey over the years from the classes that I teach here. Okay, a couple minutes more and then I will skip through all these pages. The 20th century will be documented as one of the greatest centuries, witnessing the confrontation of the aftermath of the abolition of slavery, cessation of indentured servantship, end of the British Empire. Some people still think that the British Empire has not ended, but for this time, colonization, expansion of the traditional literary canon, the granting of voting rights to women and African Americans, the re-emergence of feminism, post-colonialism, multiculturalism, globalization. Yet in 1992, when Nobel Literature Laureate Derek Walcott from the small Caribbean island of St. Lucia received the Nobel Prize in Literature, the world was still plagued by wars and conflicts on the basis of race, class, gender, religion, education, and politics. Many regions and nations were still partitioned and dehumanized. Wars in Serbia, Africa, Central America, and the Middle East raged viciously, ravishing human and lives and dignity. Against this background, the leading Caribbean playwright and poet stepped up to the podium to receive his prize, but also to deliver a powerful and revolutionary message to the rest of the world, especially Europe. Quote, "The history of the world," end quote, points out Walcott, by which, of course, we mean Europe, is a record of intertribal lacerations, of ethnic cleansing, end quote. But he called on the world to look on the Caribbean as, quote, a house on the other side of a country road whose smell is the smell of refreshing possibility as well as survival, end quote. When V.S. Naipaul won the Nobel Prize for Literature, the world plunged deeper into the throes of violence, hate, and destruction. Terrorism grabbed the world's attention, both globally and personally, dramatically and violently. The destruction of the World Trade Center, lives of human beings from hundreds of nations, symbolized intentions to fragment and crush international, intercultural, and interdisciplinary global unity and order. But at the same time, it further reinforced the importance of multicultural, transnational, transcultural, and postcolonial studies. Racial, ethnic, religious, cultural, and tribal conflicts continue to impregnate hate crimes, suicide bombing, ethnic cleansing, arms race for mass destruction, intolerance and bigotry, and spiritual and psychological enslavement. Naipaul used his own struggle to internationalize his world as a message against the attacks of the globalization and diversification of the world. Quote, "So as a child, I had this sense of two worlds," and that's the title of his Nobel speech, "the world outside that tall corrugated iron gate, and the world at home, or at any rate, the world of my grandmother's house. It was a remnant of our caste sense, the thing that excluded and shut out all of us," end quote. His pursuit of a wider world, more integrated world, was realized in Trinidad and later in England as he traveled and wrote. He says, "Away from this world of my grandmother's house, where we ate rice in the middle of the day and wheat in the evenings, there was the great unknown in this island of only 400,000 people." Of course, Trinidad has over a million people today. "They were the African and the African-derived people who were the majority. They were the white people, not all of them English, and the Portuguese and Chinese at one time, the immigrants like us, and one more mysterious and more mysterious than these were the people we call Spanish, Pagnols, mixed people of warm brown complexion who came from the Spanish time before the island was detached from Venezuela and the Spanish Empire, a kind of history absolutely beyond my child comprehension." He said that in his Nobel speech. I will just conclude here. So, all these gaps here, right? "As a result of the very nature of its historical, social, political, and cultural experiences, Caribbean studies records a uniquely complex richness of literary content and form, and this complex richness deflates a narrow parochial perspective and reflects a multiplicity of indisciplinarity, intertextuality, and multiculturalism. In telling and retelling the missing, distorted, and silenced narratives of oppressed peoples, Caribbean writers, Caribbean critics, Caribbean politicians offer intriguing perspectives on the particular and universal conditions of humanity. In terms of interdisciplinarity, they employ poetry and prose to create a mosaic of science, politics, history, psychology, language, culture, painting, and literature." And culturally, Caribbean writers use these rich cultural mixture as a literary exploration of global diversity with fresh imagination. Harris, for example, uses his African, European, and Amerindian heritage to advance these explorations and focuses on the imagination to transcend conventions into new, quote, discoveries and creations, end quote. And his title, his 1983 title, "The Womb of the Space," with its appropriate subtitle, quote, "The Cross-Cultural Imagination," end quote, captures Harris's intention. And that is, the paradox of cultural heterogeneity or cross-cultural capacity lies in the evolutionary trust it restores to orders of the imagination. The ceaseless dialogic it inserts between hardened conventions and eclipse half-clipped otherness within an intuitive self that moves endlessly into flexible patterns, areas of bridges, or communities. And as I end here, I say that this captures the heart of what we want to do in the Caribbean Studies Forum. That is, this whole what would sound as a confusing coming together of all these different disciplines, histories, cultures, races, ethnicities, and create a mosaic mass that gives out a sweet-smelling savor, as Derek Walker would say, that the rest of the world that is being played by all these frictions will see something beautiful about the Caribbean. Thank you, and sorry about the cutting.